This is Glambition Radio, episode number 14, with Woman of the Vine, Deborah Brenner. Welcome to Glambition Radio. I am your host, Allie Brown. Women are rewriting the rules for leadership, business success, making money, and changing the world. Each week, join me for powerful messages and interviews that will leave you inspired and ready to get your Glambition on. Now, let's go. Even if you don't know your Cabernet from a Chardonnay, you're going to fall in love with Deborah Brenner. For 16 years, she traveled the world as a marketer of computer technology. She had this high-profile, high-paying job this whole life, you know, in New York with her husband. And then things started to fall apart, and she decided to walk away because she wasn't doing what she loved. And in the middle of some soul searching, she found her way in Napa Valley, California, and I will let her tell the story to you in the interview. But she just leapt and believed, and today she owns Women of the Vine. It's the first and only organization focused on women winemakers, and she travels the country doing wine events. She has done stuff with the White House. I mean, it's just phenomenal what she's created. I met her in person because I invited her to be on stage at my Shine Conference in 2011, my event for women entrepreneurs. And she had just released her book within the last few years called Women of the Vine, which you should definitely pick up at womenofthevine.com. But her huge turning point was creating a partnership with Moore Magazine in the last 2 years and creating a wine club with them, which is just ideal for the demographic of that magazine. And you'll hear more about that on this interview. Tremendous business lessons in her story. I want you to listen both from a personal point of view, but also as a businesswoman, put yourself in her shoes and how she did things. And also, we're going to get some tips on wine. So let's meet women's wine champion, Deborah Brenner. Well, I am very excited for our guest today because she is all about one of my favorite subjects, especially as a new mom, and that is wine. And today we have Deborah Brenner with us. And Deborah, where are you? Are you in upstate New York today? Where are you?
I am actually in my home base office. I'm just 15 miles north of New York City in New York.
Oh, I thought you were further up. I pictured you in, up in the are there vineyards there or,
Oh, yeah. Okay. And the Hudson Valley has vineyards and, Long Island, the Finger Lakes. It's really remarkable today because we've seen such a growth in the interest of wine and agritourism. So it's exciting because there's actually wineries and vineyards in all 50 states now.
Really?
Yeah.
The whole industry sounds so romantic. And I think it's actually such a natural for women, even though, your whole mission was to unite more women in Women of the Vine. And there's so much we want to talk about today. But I think the best place to start is with you and your story. We have a lot of women listening today who are probably looking at what you've done and said, hey, how did she put this together? How did this come about? So can you go back to your marketing career that you had before all this and start there?
Sure, absolutely. And the funny thing is I didn't even realize how I put the two together until, I want to say, maybe about 5 years ago when I was preparing for a speaking engagement. And then it occurred to me that I actually, I applied to my university when I got out of high school to go to college, and I was fascinated by science. And I got into the University of Delaware as a biology major, and then realized that wasn't for me, and switched to English with minor in journalism. And now, when I wrote the book Women of the Vine, Inside the World of Women That Make, Taste, and Enjoy Wine, and got published and selected by Wine Spectator as a top read, I never thought I would put my love of science and journalism together. So you never know. 20 years later from graduating, so you could do the math how old I am, and then the book came out. So prior to that, I got into, of course, the English and the journalism side, and ended up after college pursuing a career in marketing and public relations and business development, focused on high-end technology, primarily technology that was being developed and used in the film and television industry. So again, that's part of why I was I am from New York and was working in Manhattan, traveling around the world, working for some international companies, and spent a lot of time in film studios and television studios. So quite a big reinvention and huge change when I decided to write the book and pursue my passion in the wine business.
Yeah, no, you can't just jump from, you can't do that. No, stop. Okay. You can't just say, I had this high-end job, was traveling the world. It sounded very glamorous, like a glamorous job. Did people think you were crazy because you wanted to leave? Or what was the, is there like a moment that you knew you had to make the leap?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd like to say that there was a specific moment, and I can recall the actual specific moment that made me finally take the leap of faith. But I do think that for most people, it's something that has been on their minds and certainly was on my mind for quite a while. The last 4 years of my career, I started getting more and more disenchanted with the corporate life. I was seeking a tremendous amount of balance in my life, which so many women I know are struggling with, especially in the fast-paced world of today and all the responsibilities and everything. And I was commuting, and also the higher I got up in the corporate ranks, I mean, it was great to have the financial rewards, but the personal and spiritual rewards were becoming less and less. And so it really wasn't fulfilling any longer. And so it was something that for me, it was on my mind, but I was very, I didn't know where to go and I didn't have the confidence to make that change. The catalyst for me finally saying I'm done and having, you know, the guts to do it was unfortunately going through a sudden divorce that I didn't anticipate was coming, and I had married my high school sweetheart, and you know, things just happened, and it came to me as a big surprise. And at that time, after 3 weeks after he walked out, I realized that I hadn't been living the life I wanted to live for the last, you know, 4 to 5 years. And as a partnership in a marriage, I was too scared to really say I wanted, you know, take the leap of faith because it would affect both of us. Mm-hmm. So that was the catalyst for me to say, you know, I'm going to, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I need to do this for me. And that's when I left my corporate, corporate job.
That's heavy because, you know, it sounds like he left to go pursue the life he wanted, and you wanted to do something similar to your, you know, with your life, probably staying married, but, you know, wanting to do something for yourself, but you just never stepped out. So this was that moment of you saying, I'm doing this, like
absolutely.
Enough is enough. Wow.
And I think you actually hit the nail on the head, you know, Allie, said he, you know, we were very young when we met, so no regrets, you know, we had a wonderful time, but sometimes people do grow apart. Things change as you get older, your values and your, you know, desires and lifestyle and everything. So my desire and lifestyle was something very different than his, and I just never wanted to rock the boat. But that was really, and I do tell the listeners out there, it certainly, I can't say it was the smartest thing to do, because at a time that all of a sudden I found myself single and with no income, and I didn't have the support of a spouse, and I didn't have the emotional, and I didn't have the financial support. So, you know, in hindsight, I look back and say, oh my God, I was crazy.
Everyone that I talked to, including, you know, and myself as well, when I left my last job, I was in my late 20s in New York City, and I mean, anyone with a rational train of thought would have said you're crazy. But all of us know that moment. We know the moment, like, it's too painful to stay where we are. Even if everything looks good on paper, you just say, oh, screw it. I'm doing this. And you just, you know, you're going to figure it out somehow. I mean, you knew you wouldn't be homeless, right? You knew you'd figure something out along the way.
And I think, you know, what you're saying is something that I have to remind myself a lot, and I do love to meet other women, and especially women entrepreneurs, because exactly what you said, there is definitely, you know, a personality trait And the world has to have every type of person in it. So, you know, thank goodness we're not all risk takers and entrepreneurs, because, you know, it would upset the balance. But I definitely find that there's so many people that can't understand how you could take on all of this other, you know, risk and uncertainty. And there definitely is a personality trait that, like you said, you have to somehow keep believing and reinventing yourself all the time and never giving up. And I think that's refreshing when you meet other women entrepreneurs, because I haven't met anybody that hasn't struggled and had to reshape their business model and reinvent their business model several times before they really even start feeling like they're in the right path. And if I do meet somebody that is, I usually think, you know, no, you're not being honest.
Yes. It's, yeah, we're a rare breed. It takes a lot. And it's funny because I get asked a lot about the risk taking and the leaps and I explain it in this way. It just becomes a way of being that you're not just getting out of your comfort zone. You've literally expanded your comfort zone. So you're more comfortable to kind of just with this is how we roll. We set goals, we go for them. You know, you're not laying out this huge safety net all the time. And then after a while, you realize you're going to be okay. And you take smarter risks and smarter risks. And you get, you know, sometimes you screw up, you fall down, you go backwards, turn around, go left, right. But you end up going in that direction where your heart wants to go. And so let's talk about the wine, because, you know, you were working that job. Maybe it drove you to drink more wine. where did the whole wine passion start? Because that, I know, was a you know, obviously where you were going. Were there inklings of you getting involved in this industry? Or, you know, how did this all start?
Well, it's a great question. I never could have told you I would end up in the wine business. For me, I was introduced to wine, you know, at a young age. My family, you know, would serve wine at dinners and celebrations and stuff. But my real introduction to wine was working for my corporate life, because I was working in the field of entertainment. And obviously a big part of our job was entertaining executives from, you know, film and television studios. And I had the fortunate experience to work for foreign companies. I worked for a British company for many, many years. I worked for a company based out of Rome in Italy. So I was also, I lived out of the country when I was a child for many years in South America. So I was exposed to wine at a young age in a very cultural, different sense than America. Yeah. America today has really, in the last 10 years, wine is booming in America. But prior to that, if you look back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, compared to Europe and other countries, wine wasn't as much of our culture and wasn't, you know, really paired with food and a part of the evenings and everything as we are today. So I got exposed to it from that end and was very intrigued. But what really brought me to pursue the wine industry was after I left my corporate job, I wanted to do something in hospitality, because I really missed having the opportunity to work more with people. As I mentioned, the more I got into, you know, the upper ranks in management, I found the more paperwork and meetings and things that I were doing and not really interacting with the general public the way that I enjoyed, like you, getting to meet and hearing stories and meeting all these amazing people. So I was looking at hospitality, and I actually always had a passion for agriculture. I think, as you said earlier, it seems like a natural thing for women. There's something very nurturing about being out on the land. Mm. And I took a trip to California and to Napa just to explore. I had never really been out there. And a friend of mine knew a woman who worked at one of the top wineries who formerly worked at Hewlett-Packard. And so she was kind enough to have lunch with me, because she came from a tech background and went into wine. And that's when the idea for Women of the Vine was born.
So
during our lunch.
Yeah. So there was no, union, you know, I'm saying that loosely, like of women in the wine business at all? Was there association or anything?
Nothing. I mean, huh. My first idea for Women of the Vine was 2005. I mm-hmm. started writing the book in 2006, and then it came out in 2007. At that time, the marketers weren't even addressing the woman wine consumer as being such a dominant wine consumer in the industry. Statistically, 71% of wine retail purchases in America are made by women.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
You know, women drink all kinds of other things, but wine is very much a social thing. You know, we open up a bottle, we share it with each other. It's not the same as ordering a Cosmo or, you know, a spirit or a beer. There is already a natural thing as a sharing thing. And I think that it just appeals to women in many ways, as well as, of course, you know, flavor. And I also think it pairs beautifully with food, which women traditionally have been, you know, many, you know, even though we see a lot of these incredible male chefs, I think traditionally, you know, more women have been bringing food to the family's tables. So I think there's a lot of reason why women are the largest consumer, but it took a while for the industry to really recognize it. And because of the laws of prohibition, I mean, it, you know, women weren't even allowed to drink, and they certainly weren't allowed to own land way, way back. So it's a very male-dominated industry, and especially coming out of prohibition and how a lot of the distribution network today that exists, how it came about after prohibition, was really run by a lot of, you know, it was political, it was federally and state mandated, and it's an industry that, even though there are many, many women out there breaking the glass ceiling in male-dominated industries, agriculture as a whole is something I don't think a lot of women farmers and winemakers get as much attention as I wanted them to once I started really realizing the role of these women behind the scenes of these wine labels.
Now I have to ask, what made you think you could do this? Like, you were brand new to the industry. You didn't have mm-hmm. any income. you came to, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the part I love when people make these decisions. You're out in Napa. You're having a great time. You and this gal are like, okay, we're besties. I love this. And what made you think that you would be the one to do this?
You know, I can't say why I did it. And it wasn't, honestly, it wasn't from a wine perspective. So when I went out and was seeking a publisher for the book, because once we got into Girl Talk in Napa, I immediately, my journalism, you know, and my curiosity kicked in. I came back to New York and I started, you know, spending a lot of time trying to research women that really pioneered in the wine industry. And, you know, I could read their scores from Robert Parker, their bios, but I couldn't find anything about them as women, as mothers, as daughters, as wives, as sisters, as what you are in your life, and not just your autobiography or your scores on your wine. So that's when I had the idea to write the book Women of the Vine, because I wanted to bring their stories to life.
So the book and came first. That was the
first
thing.
The book came first. So what happened was, it's not a wine book. It's not, you learn tons of stuff in the book because it has lots of sidebars from the winemakers on tips and pairings and what it takes to get from a vineyard to a glass of wine and all of that. So you do learn. But the essence of the book is really a people story with wine as the backdrop. So it's much more of an inspirational kind of story of these women and how they nurtured the land, how they got interested in the wine making business or viticulture or starting wine clubs, and how they conquered, you know, gender stereotypes and how they, you know, faced different adversity to pursue their passion.
Mm. I love that. And then when the book came out, that was 2007. And by the way, people can get the book, I know, on your website at womenofthevine.com. And is it also on Amazon and other channels like
yes.
that? Great.
Yes, it is. Okay. And if you get it on my website, I'm more than happy to autograph it for you and shipping included. And it makes, you know, sometimes people like that it can be personalized.
Perfect.
Versus Amazon.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I've had lots of people say, you know, my daughter's looking to get into this. You know, more and more women are seeing opportunities in not only viticulture and winemaking, but wine clubs, wine writing, blogging, you know, sommeliers, hospitality. So there's many, many options within the wine industry. And like I said, now there's wineries in all 50 states. So it's a really interesting thing to see people looking at it as a career option, you know,
yeah,
that they never thought about before.
So what happened after the book?
Was doing very well. Wine Spectator magazine picked it as the top read because there had never been something written about these women before. And then from the book, I decided to produce a limited production line of wines with several of the winemakers that we met during me writing the book, and we actually spent the last 5 years where they were producing wine and I was marketing and selling wine around the country and doing book signings and wine events to raise the awareness of the women in the wine business. We started hosting events. People started asking us about hosting events. And then because of my passion for supporting these women as farmers, in 2011, we were very proud Women of the Vine. We became the first and only wine partner of FarmAid, founded by Willie Nelson and Neil Young and John Mellencamp. So we started doing events and ongoing donations to support FarmAid and their mission to keep America's family farmers on the land. And then in 2013, last year, I partnered with More Magazine, and we launched the first of its kind wine club with a national women's lifestyle magazine featuring all women vintners. So
yeah,
we're very excited.
When I saw that, I said, "Oh, I know her! I know her! I know Deborah Brenner!" I was all excited. I love that magazine. And if you don't get it, everyone, you should get this More Magazine. Even if you know, I think it's targeted to women in their 30s and older, but it's just such an intelligent read. Like, if you're done with the magazines that talk to you kind of insultingly, you know, like how to tell if a guy likes you and that stuff. Like, you know, it's like we're too
absolutely
old for that. More is so intelligent. And when I saw that you had paired up with them, I was like, that is just freaking brilliant. I mean, it's just the right demographic. And I'm curious, mm-hmm, you know, I haven't asked you, but how has that worked out for you? Has it really expanded your reach? And how are they to work with? Is it fun?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. And the most amazing thing, and just to tell the listeners, especially the entrepreneurs, you never know where it's going to lead. I was pitching More Magazine for a year to be one of their reinvention stories because it's one of the most popular sections of the magazine.
I love that section.
It is, because it's all women like myself that have, you know, taken this big leap of faith. Well, finally, I got a call from the features editor saying, we have a place for you in the April issue. This was going back in 2012, and I was a reinvention story. And because I knew the statistics of women, I knew that there was Wall Street Journal, Zagat, New York Times, all these wine clubs out there, but nobody was doing this. I went back to the features editor and said, is there somebody I could talk to at More Magazine about potentially looking at a wine club? And she put me in touch with Ann Baird, who's the wonderful head of marketing for More. And that was it. We couldn't shut up on the phone because when I called her and told her all of the statistics and what was going on in demographic, it was like reading More Magazine's, you know, mm-hmm, demographic. And it was a celebration of smart women. It wasn't the gimmicky wine labels out there like Mommy's Time Out and, you know, all these things,
yeah,
that are trying to capture. We don't make wine for women. We just happen to be women making great wine. So it was such a perfect thing for More. And the beauty of it is More wanted to look into a wine club, but most wine clubs, there's no personality. There's no face to them. You just get wine. The beauty of the More Uncorked with Women of the Vine Wine Club is that you're being introduced to these women, and it's a continuation of my book, but you get to drink their wine. So you get to read about them. And the best part is, as a member, you also get membership benefits to be able to visit their wineries and get discounts and meet these women. And so, Allie, it's funny we're doing this interview today because I'm flying to Napa tomorrow for the second annual Women of the Vine Grand Tasting, sponsored by Moore Magazine. Last year, to launch the wine club, it was the first ever done where we did a grand tasting in Napa, and 30 of some of the top, most notable women winemakers and proprietors all came out and poured the wine themselves.
Wow.
So unlike wine events that we have all over the country, to be true to Women of the Vine and what I believe for what we want to do, in order to pour your wine and participate, you have to be there yourself. So, like, for instance, Heidi Barrett, the only person in the world to get 5 100-point perfect scores from Robert Parker, she will be
wow.
there pouring her wine. So you're not meeting a marketing rep. You're not meeting
right.
a person from your wine distributor or your local wine shop. You're meeting the Women of the Vine, and that's what makes it really exciting. And this is the second annual, and asking how it's going. When we first launched last year, due to licensing and all kinds of things, you know, out there, we were limited to only be able to feature women vintners from California. But we will be making the announcement at the event, so you're the first ones to hear it. We are going global. We are making some changes, and as of May, we will be able to introduce women from all over the United States and all over the world into the Moore Uncorked Wine Club.
Wow. I wish I
yeah.
could come. You know, next time I got to find out way ahead, because I will bring a bunch of women. I mean,
we would love
that. What a
that.
Great girls' weekend.
Well, it's going to be the beginning of March, because March is Women's History Month. And believe it or not, Women's History Month was founded by the National Women's History Project to get women's history in the curriculums of our school system in 1975. And they're based in Santa Rosa in Sonoma. So it's Women's History Month. March 8th is our event, which happens to be International Women's Day. So that was a big reason why we tried to do this in March. So mm-hmm. keep that in mind for next year. But it's a great way to celebrate, you know, the accomplishments of women in all, you know, businesses and moms and everything else that women are contributing out there.
So if you don't mind, I'm going to ask a little bit about your business model, because I don't quite understand how you work with the vintners. You know, are you getting a percentage of sales, or is there a fee for them to belong to your organization? I'm still not quite clear on how it works.
Sure. Well, right now, obviously, I continue to sell my book and going to be updating and putting out a new edition of the book. So with my publisher. So the book is
right.
one side of my business. The other side of my business is a wine consultant. So I do have other clients to help bring some wine to market for them that they're looking for brand extensions of their businesses. So that's kind of something that I do, you know, obviously, you know, for my business. And then for Moore Uncorked, I do get a percentage of sales. I develop the wine club. I work with the women winemakers. I bring them on board. I write their stories. I work with them to write the tasting notes. And then I work with Moore Magazine, you know, to do the food pairings. So, and then we have a warehouse and fulfillment and customer service company, a wonderful group, which happens to be a lot of women out in San Rafael that handle all of the back end of, you know, running the wine club, because obviously you need a lot, you know, software wise. And we're actually going to be taking down our site now, and you can go and register on moreuncorked.com. We're going to be launching the whole new and improved and global site by May 1st. But so for my job, it's I basically get you know, a commission and revenue as a partner with Moore Magazine in creating this wine club.
Got it. Thank you. Because we're all business owners, I'd like to just understand and have everyone listening see how you've created this business that, you know, you love, but with multiple streams of income, and you get to work with people
important.
In different ways. Yeah.
I think especially depending on how you are, not everybody is going to open up a restaurant or open up a storefront or provide a service that has one direct business model and revenue stream. So, you know, like you're saying, Allie, a lot of people, you know, if you can have your own, you know, practice, if you're a lawyer, if you can, there's very direct revenue streams. But I think for other people that may be in more creative type things, I know a lot of people in creative services, they struggle how to find that. And I struggled too to find it. So the partnership with Moore Magazine is one thing, my book, but I will tell you my ultimate goal, and it just, I have to build the brand and have the right partners in place. Like this year, Rito Glass just came on board as a sponsor. Carolyn Pollock Jewelry just came on board. But what my ultimate goal for 2015 is exactly what you were asking, is to have Women of the Vine become the first wine, you know, alliance for women in the wine industry, in all walks of the wine industry, and be a membership organization and nonprofit where, like the Napa Valley Vintners Association or, you know, the California Sustainable Grape Association, there isn't an association that exists for women to come together. So that is my ultimate goal, but I've been spending my time working on the partnerships, building the brand, and bringing, I think, you know, when I think about why would members want to join and what benefit would they get out of it, that's what I'm building now.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're getting all the pieces ready, and it sounds like it's just a given. I mean, what woman vintner wouldn't want to be a part of that? That's phenomenal.
Well, it gives them the publicity, but also having the wine club, because, you know, we love associations that are educational. There's lots of wine associations that are nonprofits and educational. But at the end of the day, for these women to give up their valuable time, I mean, we can't forget they're farmers. And they're in agriculture, and Mother Nature's dictating their schedules, and it's a very demanding job. That for them to give up their time, I didn't want it just to be for educational. I wanted to give them an outlet to actually sell their wine.
Yeah,
because
that's
we want
very
to
practical.
Keep them employed.
Yes. Yeah, fantastic. You know, you know, I didn't join the club before because I thought it wasn't available in Arizona, but the rules are changing now, right?
It was not available, but the new launch of this in May, it will be available
Yay!
In Arizona. Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Because I'm already in another wine club, but we need more wine all the time. It was funny. You sign up for these things, ladies, listen, you sign up for these things and you think a truck's going to back up, you know, but it, really, you go through this so quickly that you'll be waiting for your next shipment usually.
Yeah. And you know, it's
so
4, 6, or 12 bottles of wine. So it's based on people. Yeah, you could do a 4, 6. And I will tell you what's fun is I've had some people that do the 12 and they split it. And then it gives them, you know, a good excuse for them to meet up, you know, and get together. We also have, I've gotten emails from one, I love this. I got an email from a woman that has a knitting club. And so this is like part of their knitting club. They chip in and then they get the wine. And we also have heard from book clubs that have done that. So it's just a very interesting thing. Plus you could shop anytime on the store and you don't have to belong to the club.
So I want to ask you, well, there's a few things, and in the interest of time, I know you're about to jet off to Napa. I love your life. tell me, you know, can you give us a few tips first on wine in general and choosing a good wine? And then I'd love you to wrap up with your three tips for all the women listening, you know, in stepping into their highest good. They may be considering starting a business or making a life change, but I'd love some tips on wine because I know you've learned a lot.
Absolutely. And everything I've learned from the winemakers themselves, which is, you know, just so fascinating because they all approach it so differently. You know, some approach it very scientifically, but the majority in the consensus is it's really an art. It's just like a chef. You can't put a formula together. It's a feel and it's an instinct. And, you know, I think the most important thing is to explore and have some fun with it, realize that it is agriculture, so it is coming from grapes, and the different grapes that are out there is what produces the different flavors. Best way to explain it is like apples. You know, you have Macintosh and Granny Smith and, mm-hmm. you know, all these different, well, that's your Sauvignon Blanc and your Chardonnay, so everything's going to have its own nuances. And once you explore them and you find what you like, then the important thing is to look at, you know, do you like a lot of oak? Do you like a little bit of oak? Because it changes the flavors. It's like adding certain spices to your food, adding rosemary, which is, you know, a pretty powerful, you know, aroma, can really, you know, for some people they love it, other people they don't. And I just tell people to just pay attention the same way they do with their food, because that's how you can pick and choose wines that you really like. And you start to learn about it. So wine stores and in restaurants, they love to help you find a wine you like. So if you can say, you know, I like a Chardonnay, but I don't like too much oak. I like it crisp and citrus. You know, they'll be right there to help you. Mm-hmm. The other thing is for pairing. There are no steadfast rules of food and wine pairing, and I think it intimidates people. I have so many women that come up to me and say, you know, I hear I'm supposed to drink red wine with meat and with pork and with this, but I don't like red wine. I like white wine. That's absolutely fine. I mean, you drink what you like, and you don't worry about it. It's supposed to be fun. We don't want it to be, you know, snobby or mysterious. And don't be afraid to drink in the price points that you're in. Price point is not indicative of necessarily if you're going to like it or not. It's just like, you know, buying, you know, a piece of clothing just because it's really expensive and designer doesn't mm-hmm. mean it's going to look good.
I think we've all had that experience of picking up, you know, the occasional $10 bottle of wine and we're blown away at how good it is if it's something we really like.
Absolutely. I mean, when people ask me then why are there such a big difference of, you know, prices and stuff, the prices in wine is much more indicative of the quantity, you know, that was available because it is agriculture, how the grapes are blended, because if an estate blend, it's coming all from that one vineyard, whereas other blends, it will be mixed with wines, grapes grown in many different vineyards. So you're getting more of that concentrated local, and also of your farming practices, you know, organic farming practices, sustainable farming do cost the farmers more to produce the grapes. So that cost has to go somewhere. So in good sustainable farming practices, limited quantity of wines that are, you know, being farmed in very specific blocks to keep flavors, that's where you're going to really see the highest concentration of flavor and the more expensive. But it certainly doesn't mean that you'll even like it. There's plenty of great wine out there. And, you know, so I think that's also what made America become more, you know, culturally bringing wine to the dinner table on a regular basis is because it's now affordable.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and tell me if you have this experience too, but now I'm in my 40s now. I can't drink cheap wine anymore. It really hits me harder. And I think as you get older, ladies, I'd love to share with me online when you hear this, like if it's true, but I really feel it now. I mean, college, you know, we're drinking Boones and crap like that.
Oh yeah. I'm in my 40s too, my late 40s. So
right. So you and I, Bartles and James, oh my gosh, remember that stuff? So, you know, so we've come a long way, baby. So today,
I'll tell you what a lot of that is. And here's the little secret. Mm-hmm. When we all started drinking alcohol, whether it was wine or mixed drinks or something, we all tended, I mean, again, as a stereotype, but a lot of us tended to start with sweeter drinks because they tasted better. And if we, you know, we all know that sweet drinks can cause that, you know, hangover and,
gives you the
and
worst.
Not feel so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem with a lot of the very inexpensive wines is that they leave some residual sugar And whereas we ferment our wines dry, which means that the yeast ferments all of the sugar into alcohol. But if you leave a little bit of sugar in there, it can make a wine taste more full-bodied. It gives it more flavor, a little sweetness. So that's why a lot of times the less expensive wines, they're doing some modern winemaking techniques to get the price point.
They're cheating.
And that's kind of it's making it taste a little better, but it's not making you feel so good.
Yeah, it repeats on you then. Is there a way to tell that? You know, but I mean, obviously, you know, you can look, if you see a wine that's really cheap and just looks, you know, bizarrely cheap, but you know it's a cheap wine. But is there a way to tell from the label?
The label doesn't give it to you, and it's rare unless you're doing, you know, real judging or anything that they would ask about residual. But if you start paying attention to it as you taste, you'll start to taste when it feels like there's, you know, a little bit of sweetness to it.
Got it.
But generally the rule of thumb is you could get some great bottles of wine, you know, in your $9 to $15 range. It's a huge popular, you know, range right now. And then you could go up from there. But when you get below that, then you're seeing more of...
That's the danger zone.
You're seeing more of the modern wine making techniques.
So
happening.
Ladies, yeah, splurge, go for over the $10. Listen to Deborah and myself. You'll feel a lot better in the morning. And I also am a big fan. I think all of us should, you know, when you can spend the money, always support organic farming, sustainable farming. I know that you're a big proponent of that with Women of the Vine as well.
And that's big with my partnership with FarmAid because absolutely, we have to sustainably farm and be so careful because otherwise we're just depleting all of the nutrients out of the soil.
Yeah.
There's nothing left, and it's healthier for the land, but it's also healthier for us in the long run too. But it is, you know, we want to sustain, you know, the land as much to be nurturing and giving for any crop. And, you know, that's what FarmAid's mission is to get people to understand that, you know, we had such industrial boom of our farming and mass production that it really was killing the soil for the future.
It's so great to see so many people now really start paying attention to this and wanting to support this. And I think, you know, we're at the verge of seeing a turnaround in this country.
I agree. It's wonderful.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
And next year is FarmAid's 30th anniversary. So,
oh, wow.
You know, Willie Nelson started it a long time ago when a lot of people at that time, you know, were not even paying attention at all.
He was ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So to wrap up, you know, you've been so gracious in sharing your stories and your vulnerability. And especially thank you for sharing the story about, you know, your marriage and making these transitions, and because so many of us are going through these things, and these are the things that often are not talked about on the business shows. That's why I wanted to do Glambition Radio. You know, we really want to hear the stories and what women go through to get where they are. And they always say, I'm so glad I'm on the other side. I'm so glad this happened to me. I'm in a better place. And would you say that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are your three tips for success for everyone listening?
You know, I have to say that I'm not making these up. These come from the farmers. I will admit I was born in the Bronx. I grew up in the suburbs of Manhattan. I worked in Manhattan. I've, you know, traveled all over in big cities. I was not exposed to farming and to farmers a lot in my life. And now I'm so thrilled I have the opportunity because the things that they taught me every day are the most valuable lessons I learned in entrepreneurship. And I think the first thing is to be resilient. You know, they're working for Mother Nature. So when I complain about, like, you know, my computer having glitches, we can fix that. They can't necessarily fix the rain, the snow, the freezing weather we're having. They have to deal with it. And I'm in awe of how they do that. So the resiliency, I think, is just something that I get reminded of all the time. I think the other, you know, things that they've taught me also is having hope and always believing in you know, it being better. They see harvest to harvest, and they are nurturing the land to give back. And that goes back to what we were saying before, reinvention. When it comes from resiliency and that, these guys are reinventing themselves every year. Especially, you know, you look at the grapes, they get pruned down to absolutely nothing. And then bud break is going to start happening, you know, in May. And all of a sudden, everything blooms. And then you harvest again in the fall. So every year, they're reinventing. And I'm thinking, wow, if I reinvent myself, you know, 2-3 times in my lifetime, you know, that's enough for me. Mm-hmm. It's hard enough. So I think that they've taught me such life lessons that I never expected. And I think the most important thing, you know, for everyone is you have to believe in yourself. And you're going to have lots of naysayers around you, mostly because of their own fear. They may not have that same, entrepreneurial spirit. It's not for everybody. It's not for the faint of heart. But when you have it, trust yourself in it, because like you said, at the end of the day, even if you fail over and over, all those failures turn into learning experiences, and then someday you're going to say, oh my gosh, you know, I made it.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
I think that's important.
Deborah, thank you so much for joining us today. I just want to tell everyone, please go to womenofthevine.com. And the More website is which one?
It's moreuncorked.com.
Moreuncorked. And there's events going on. You know, I'd love to put something together with you. We talked about that at, even at Shine. And I think, you know, even more so now, I think women are getting a lot more interested in wine and learning about it. And it's just like, I have a crush on your career. I just feel like this is this whole romantic industry. I know there's all stuff we don't see behind the scenes, right? But it just feels like this beautifully feminine, like you said, the whole industry that was, you know, this was whole, all of agriculture has been so industrialized and masculinized. And it's the same thing, really, if you look at like corporate business, it was extremely industrialized, all by men and built by men, which is great. We needed that and get stuff done and all that. And now you see women coming in kind of just very graciously and gracefully into these industries and shifting things. And things change, mm-hmm. and they evolve, and the women care about the land. They care about what they're putting out in the market. If it's a different type of business, they care about their clients. It's turning the whole world around, and you are such a beautiful part of that. And I'm getting just a little like emotional, because it also has to do with taking care of the earth and the land. And mm-hmm. I just think what you do is just so wonderful. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you, Allie. And let's definitely make something happen. I think it would be a great celebration at your Shine.
I would love
and,
that.
And I'd love to see these women shine and celebrate together. So,
fantastic.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. Have fun in Napa. Okay. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, I hope you liked this episode of Glambition Radio. If you did, please share this show with someone you know and help spread the word to your followers on social media. Glambition is a movement, and I am honored to be on this journey with you all. I'd love to hear from you at alliebrown.com. Come drop a note there on my blog or catch up with me on Facebook and other social media. You'll see the links at my website, alliebrown.com. Take care and God bless.